You're listening to CIOI, The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Bob Wiseman, a musician based in Toronto, Ontario, who just published a book called Music Lessons, out on ECW Press. This interview was originally recorded on August 6, 2020. Introduce yourself, if you're willing, for listeners.
I'm Bob Wiseman.
And do you want to tell me a bit about yourself?
Well, I make a living from music-related things. That's what I've been doing, luckily, in some ways, for a long time, or I've been engaged in trying to make music things be my way of moving through life. So that's taken the form of producing records or doing music for film or TV or writing books or teaching in privately or in or classrooms about songwriting or about improvisational piano. I think that's, I guess, probably enough stuff. People in Toronto often try to, like, list everything they're doing when they're asked, what do you do or what's new? And it was a really interesting moment when I heard them say that, because I realized, I do that. I do that all the time. And I kind of, when I thought about it a little further, I thought, that's about being insecure, I think, about the fact that it's hard to make a living as an artist, and that, and I think sometimes when I'm listing all these things, it's like trying to prove that it's okay or that it's legitimate or something like that. And so then I kind of like to play with short-circuiting that sometimes and just answering that question at parties or whatever in a way that's unexpected by saying, you know, so what are you doing lately, you know, and instead of listing the records I'm involved with or other music things, I like to say nothing. And it goes because it's flat. It's just like you can feel the kind of it's like socially wrong move, and then people have to kind of be polite or whatever too, you know, if there is nothing, because truly sometimes my answer is nothing. I'm not doing anything, or I don't, you know, I'm involved with something but it's not finished, so what's the point? Whereas previously I would talk about the thing that hasn't even started yet, but has only been promised or whatever, to just justify my existence as an artist. But I don't need to, or one doesn't need to do that anyways.
Well, I often, when I ask, do you want to introduce yourself? I feel almost like it's unfair to ask someone to introduce themselves without any parameters given. But the alternative, if I introduce a guest, I feel like I'm telling them who they are, and that feels less fair. So when I allow somebody to introduce themselves on their terms, it usually sets up sort of the structure for what they're comfortable, I guess, identifying about themselves, or it gives me a starting place for exploring.
What makes it feel less fair to you?
Well, So for example, I interview a lot of seniors living in retirement residences, and I'll often ask questions like what they did for fun when they were little, and it's so much more broad than it sounds, because you think like, oh, like I'm just asking them to list a few activities, but in a way I'm asking them to define their entire childhood of leisure. And I had one ask me what I did for fun growing up, and I blanked. I couldn't think of a single thing, and I realized how cruel I had maybe been to ask this question to everybody, as if they just walk around with a list of things to tell me. And so, yeah, I guess when I ask people to introduce themselves, it feels similarly like how many of them walk around with the script of exactly what to say, and how many have very tidy, easy points to point to. That I think that's part of it too.
Great story.
I want to ask you about this book, because I've been following your status updates and little sorts of posts over the past few years, and I believe the book is sort of a culmination of a lot of those thoughts, correct?
Yeah, it's just it's about a year and a half of them. It's okay. Just 2017, 2018, ECW Press just told me that they'd like to release some of them. So I said, you can do whatever you want. And they were like, which ones should we take? And I said, whichever you want. And they were like, okay, should we categorize them? Should we like make chapters for different themes? Basically, you perhaps know a bit about this, being someone who's a musician and who's formed groups and who's made different kinds of recordings. But you also might not. Personally, in work that I did when I was younger, it interested me to try and be in charge of everything. Mm-hmm. And work that I do, and it's kind of morphed over time, I think, because I've recognized certain artworks that have really knocked me out weren't made by one person taking care of every detail. I started to realize more about how collaboration works, more about how certain things arrive at being powerful to me, partly because some people had the nerve or the guts or whatever to kind of accept that their opinion didn't win at the end of the day. And so it's made me, it's sort of like the story of saying, what are you doing? Nothing. I kind of am interested in not necessarily controlling stuff. So with ECW Press, I was like, they were like, should we name these chapters? What should we name them? I was like, whatever you want. Like, you know, which ones should we take? Whatever you want. And what should we call the book? You can call it whatever you want. You know, I suggested a title, How to Write a Bad Song, because that's one of my assignments when I teach. And they were like, yeah, that's cool. But then they came back and like, how about music lessons? And I was like, sure. So I'm kind of liking just seeing the thing succeed or fail. But my investment is different, kind of, for trying to be more like water than like, would the opposite be like fire? But to be able to bend and just like get along and see where that goes.
Yeah, would the opposite be like the thing that's holding the water, maybe?
Yeah, rather than being, I'm thinking more of the being a cul-de-sac or being somehow a force, a dam. Yeah,
a dam. There's a good one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it still lets them through, but kind of on your own terms. Yeah. Well, I mean, it did kind of answer one of my wonderings, which was whether or not, when you were writing them in the first place, you knew they were going to culminate in this form. And I think that is sort of one of the interesting things to not know while reading it, I guess, because I don't know whether it would look different if you had thought about how it would turn out or where it would end up, or if you would have self-edited without even realizing it, if you thought there was a possibility that you'd give over full control and everything may be included. And so at any point, were you aware it was going to culminate in something, or was it always? No.
No, because from my point of view, it already was published.
Yeah.
It's online, and people reacted. And it's not even about people. Like, it's more about, you know, my own mental health or my own thinking process or my own working out questions that I have through writing. And that's it. That's the primary objective, and that's already met. When they offered to put it out, that was what I said. Well, it already is out. And they're, you know... But there's a lot more than what they did in this book. And they were like, we just want to take 500. And so I said, yeah, okay. So anyway, no. But when I mean, I've been writing since longer than this. It's just about 3 or 4 years ago. The guy who helps me with my website set it up that when I put it on the www Bob Wiseman, it goes to Facebook and Twitter and things like that. So once that started happening, there was a lot more... response right away, because Facebook is occupied by so many zillions of people. And so
they did just choose 500.
We went back and forth 2 or 3 times, and I just kind of sent them a dump, like, here's a whole year if you want. So I gave them like 2017, and they were like, it could be longer than that. And so then I just carried on from the end of 2017 up till, I don't remember, but it's about, I don't know, 16 or 18 months of daily writing. But what I was going to say is, once it went on to Facebook, some people wrote me and they were like, "Hey, is this a book? Like, I'd like to get a copy of this book, Bob." You know, like, and there were a few questions like that, and I just was like, "No," I would say, "Well, no, here it is. It's like you're seeing it right now. Like, if you like it, like that's the extent of it." So no, I wasn't waiting for it or planning or thinking about editing myself in a certain way. Someone I know who's a professor at a university was telling me in a recent conversation about a concern they have for their job, for things that they've said in the past that they might be held accountable for now in a way that they're scared or paranoid or whatever. And they said to me, "You better go back and look at your work and things that you've said." And I kind of thought, I don't need to do that. I don't write anything that I don't stand by or that I'm like paranoid about. Even if there's a few people that like that I name names sometimes that have said that to me. They're like, "Oh, I love that you name names." And it's like, I don't feel so brave or something. It's just, I don't mind. Like, it's just spitting out what I know if apparently I do know anything.
I think you and I have that in common. I guess, I mean, the standing behind, but I think because of my ADD maybe, or my brain, or I get kind of, I try to describe it like if you have a hard drive failure and all the files are still there, but the table of contents is messed up. That's like, I think I've got all the things in my brain still, but sometimes I don't have like the table of contents to in a real clear linear way. So I sort of have to assume all the time, anytime I'm out in the world, whether it's online or just in person, that everything I'm doing is public. And I sort of have to, in real time, assess it all the times, because I just have to assume I'll never be able to go back and change it. And so why do it anyway other than the way that feels right the first time? It's sort of easier. It feels like there's no way they could go back and find a mistruth, or I might have changed. I mean, I guess that's an interesting thing. It maybe people change somewhere down the line and then they can't agree with past them, or they don't identify with it. And I guess that's a possible challenge if people make a major change. But in terms of like posting or sharing something that you'd never believed, that's interesting to think anybody ever was comfortable doing that.
The person who gave me that criticism also does. I know that they are very concerned about what people think of them. In a different way than I am, I think. So I think that's part of it for them and for me. You know, I think it's one of the stories even in the book that I worked with Freddie Stone at one point, and he used to play with Duke Ellington, and he was kind of the big teacher in Toronto for improvisation. And one of the kind of two things that he left me with was to forget about the audience. And I took that as a metaphor, really, for like more than just performance, but more for living. When you talked about ADD, did you mean that as a metaphor, or did you mean that you have ADD?
No, I do have ADD, so it's not really a metaphor. But I also, it's so embedded in the way that I do all of the things that I don't say that as a sort of a apology or like disability. I mean, there's moments where maybe it's less than ideal, but I think it's also pretty tied into the things that work really well for my brain too. So sort of just feels inseparable at this point from the way that I do things, I guess.
Okay.
It's neat sometimes when I'm talking to other people who, I mean, people don't always identify it as that. And I mean, I don't even know, I guess, literally, if that's the chemical imbalance's name, or if there's such a thing as an imbalance. But I can sometimes follow other people's lost table of contents easier too. Mm-hmm. Like I can catch the thread between their seemingly unrelated points better than maybe people that don't ever have a brain that gets mixed around like that. I don't know.
For sure. Yeah. I take a lot of pride in getting along with all kinds of people, there's lots of people that I can get along with that many other people I know can't, because it just upsets them that how not straight they are. And it's like, that's no big deal. Like, especially if they're an artist generating work that interests me.
Yes. In terms of these lessons, So when you were first posting them, I guess the part where you were describing that you were putting them online and then they were going to Facebook, I believe I started seeing them probably right around that time. And I read them right away every single time. I think because I know that no matter how often I click save for later, I don't remember to go back. And I didn't know if they were ever going to end up somewhere that I could look at them later. And so in a strange way, I read more of your book over the years than all the other books I've set aside in the so-called safe for later. But then when I had the collection of them, which has tons I didn't see in real time, I still kind of struggled with whether or not I would want to read them all at once.
Yeah.
Because I think part of what I really enjoyed was that you would pop in and present a lesson when I wasn't expecting it or even looking for it, but I still enjoyed it so much. And when you have a collection of them, it's like, can you really learn the same way from this type of stuff all at once? And how do you feel about the idea if somebody's coming upon this material for the first time in a body, should they be like taking it in little pieces? Like, should they set it down and only pick it up every once in a while? Do you think the lessons are different if you try to take it all on in one sitting?
I have no idea. And you know, like, hearing you put the question that way makes me realize that it might be pretentious calling it music lessons, because I'm not thinking that it's music lessons for anybody as much as, okay, it's more, it was their idea to call it that. And I agreed to it because I thought, yeah, it's like a poetic way to talk about, to refer to what I'm doing for me in what I'm writing, like, because I'm like looking at how music or all any music, like that's basically what the continuity, I think, in all the things that I'm writing is, it has something to do with music.
Mm-hmm.
Each piece has something to do with music, but ultimately a lot of them have a lot more to do with other things than music. I'm just using music as like a starting point to kind of pivot away to other things that have to do with life and living life, which I think are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of enjoying it in one sitting, I don't know. I mean, anything, it speaks. I guess it keeps you interested for a bit and then it doesn't. And then, people I know that are talking to me about it, that have read it and that have liked it, like it for that reason, for starting and stopping anywhere and for the mm-hmm. fact that it's not a linear experience.
Yeah, that was another thing that struck me was, so assuming that there was some amount of you learning by rearticulating the moment, which is maybe just a guess on my part that would happen, but inevitably for me, if I write out something that occurred to me, I will kind of learn from it as I'm writing it, because it's just a different way of processing it. So if I have an interaction with a person, maybe I learn something, but when I go to write out exactly what that moment meant, I'll be like, okay, that's what I learned. It's sort of like where I get the script. And so I was curious if it would change over time, if you would be a person who had learned more in the span of years. And so then maybe in later entries, it's like a different Bob Wiseman who's learning. But I don't know.
Are you trying to say, do I learn something more over time?
Well, like, yeah, I guess, is there a point that you noticed that you'd already learned so much from writing these out that it was already shaping then the later points where you're learning? Like, did you start to learn differently or start to know, like, hey, I'm having one of those interactions, this is going to mean something, and start listening from like a different part of your brain?
Yeah, sometimes since writing every day, it happens in front of my face on any given day that, like, oh, in addition to the fact that this police officer just pulled me over, I'm going to be writing about this in a few hours, because the guy's wearing a pin on his thing of a saxophone, like whatever it is, like that. Sure. That happens. Yeah.
Do you become like somebody observing and less able to be also equally present in the interaction itself?
No, I don't think so. No. My primary thing isn't to kind of like write about what's going on. I'm more interested in being present with what's going on. It's a secondary thing to think about writing about it.
Can you, for listeners, talk about where or what your sort of lifestyle and workplace looked like during the writing? So I know, like, at one point you were going to school, I believe, but you were also teaching, and I'm not sure where one or the other overlaps and how much of that was taking place during this particular body of work.
Well, I mean, different, whatever's going on is usually, I'm writing about things that have happened to me in the past and things that are going on in the present. So, yeah, in recent years I was at York and I was doing my master's in environmental studies. And in recent years I was also teaching at Centennial College, and I was also teaching privately. And then last year I taught at the University of Western, and I'm teaching there again. And now I'm doing a PhD at Guelph. At the International Institute for Critical Studies and Improvisation.
Yeah, I just interviewed Ajay yesterday.
Oh, yeah. This thing that you and I are doing right now might end up tonight or tomorrow or next week in me thinking about just things that happened. So, did I answer your question accurately? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I was just curious about the sort of background of, I guess, like, what else you were up to that maybe, like, influenced the circumstances that led to the little anecdotal. But, yeah, I guess maybe it's not as important or integral to those narratives at any given time.
You know, consciousness interests me. The mind interests me. Primarily forever, since forever. And that whole, you know, tradition that some people follow of working on oneself, working on the self, putting your mind under a microscope, whatever tradition people follow, whether it's a religion or whether it's Zen or Sufi stories or mysticism or Fritz Perls or Freud, one of the works one might do is self-reflection. Even one of the people, when I returned to school, one of the kind of big names that people drop all the time is Foucault. And Foucault is an interesting guy. And he writes in one of his books, he wrote about, actually the story, he was making reference to this thing years ago. And it might even be, I'm not sure who's, what era, and I can't pronounce them. I don't remember the word. It's a long word for a. But basically, it's a word that connotates self-writing, and there's a real interest, value in and tradition of self-writing, of like stopping, and whether it's a daily practice or a monthly practice, but maybe that's part of what's in it for, you know, Margaret Atwood or anybody who writes novels is you know, because that's one of the things that I realized from doing this is that, like, oh, to write I think that same work probably works for fiction writers too, that part of what you're doing is you're working out things that, you know you're displacing it into characters, but it probably has to do, if it's, well, I bet in a lot of instances it has to do with what people, what they've actually learned, what their knowledge is, assuming they have some.
Well, I don't know if it fully connects to your point, but it feels like it does. When I first started doing interviewing for radio stuff, it was just to have more and different voices on the radio. So there was no other goal. So no deadline, no particular markers of what was or wasn't appropriate. So the only kind of boundaries would maybe be like, I'm going to be in this neighborhood doing this for the next few months, or I'm going to be in this retirement center. But in terms of who I talked to or what we talked about, it was entirely open-ended. And the very, very little first stages of that, I had a lot of anxiety that I'd never have enough time in the whole world to get everyone's story. And then right after that was no anxiety whatsoever, because that very exact same thing. It's like, I'll never have enough time to get all the stories. And so it was weird. Nothing changed about the reality, but everything changed about the anxiety. And the same thing happened when the pandemic started. I had a momentary, I have to capture everybody's raw and honest feelings about this pandemic in their earliest days, because we're going to start to self-edit. We're going to start to lie to ourselves about our feelings. And then very shortly after was like, I don't need to worry because we're going to do that. And so, yeah, I guess it's like, I'm curious about the, I don't know, but not the anxiety in your case necessarily, but the where you become aware of the self-editing, but that's okay because it's almost inevitable, as opposed to maybe like there was a time where you were operating without knowing you were making any kind of like editing decisions at all. It's not really a question, I guess. It's just sort of a tether, your process and how I relate to it, I guess. I don't know.
One of the nice things that you make me think of when you talk about your what you did with your thoughts at the beginning of the pandemic, you remind me about the fact that one of the things I gain from writing frequently about what's going on is memory down the road of what was going on, because the human condition doesn't, the memory in each of us doesn't work so great. You know, we remember certain emotional events, but you know, what did you eat for lunch three Tuesdays ago? We don't have like an immediate Rolodex of like what happened. And so when, you know, my daughter's eight now, when I read a story about when she was five and crying about this thing or that, it's like, it's better than a picture. It's better than a video. For me, it's kind of like, oh, it brings me to the moment again that's totally like a wave that disappeared into the lake, you know, that I'm seeing again. And Magli and maybe someone else who doesn't even know me, but has had a five-year-old at one point in their life, maybe gets off on some of those same kinds of emotional memories.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Bob Wiseman, a musician based out of Toronto, Ontario, who has just published a book called Music Lessons. Yeah, I remember hearing that the things you think you remember the best are actually the things that are probably the least similar to how they actually happened, that every time you remember a memory, you change it a little in the retelling. And so when there's some sort of hypnosis or something comes back to you, maybe you run into an old friend and a memory comes up that feels like a fresh one that you've never re-remembered, that's maybe the closest to accurate to how it actually happened, is that very first moment that it comes back seemingly out of nowhere, compared to one you've told over and over again. Like, I one time forgot that a person even existed and then saw them and was trying to remember who they were. And by the time I figured out who they were, I realized a whole year of my life I had interacted with this person quite a lot. And the entire year had vanished from my head until I saw them. And then later I was like, maybe now I have access to a whole year more authentically because I haven't retold it at any point since I last saw them.
Huh. Yeah.
Maybe some of your closest friends or strongest memories are more story than memory in a way.
Maybe.
Do you like to go back and read the things from before?
No, I don't, but I'm pausing and answering it because I'm making an audio book of it right now. But I'm having someone else read them. And so Karen Gordon, who I don't know well, but I've heard her over the years on CBC. She's a guest host sometimes. And I met her years ago, and so I was friends with her. But I know her better now because I've worked with her a bunch of times on the book. And I really love her voice. And I kind of just wanted to... anyways, as she reads parts of it, I end up, you know, sometimes I'm really amused at like what comes next, because I don't read it after it's old news already, and it's sometimes it's really quite a lot of fun to hear her read it, or to help answer her trying to figure out how to read it, like what did I mean by this or that.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you think she needs to know what you meant to read it properly?
she needs to know what I meant to read it properly, yeah.
Do we need to know what you meant to read it properly?
I think, yes and no, but I mean, you can't control that. So, but it's more like some of the things that confuse her, if I was a reader, they confused me, I would have to consider them from different angles to make sense out of it. And so I think her confusion has to do with the pressure of performing right now. And mm-hmm. so I think if she was just a reader at home, she would get it too. And if she didn't, so what? There's 500 of them, so she'd go on to the next one, you know?
I only listened to audiobooks a small handful of times and hadn't really thought about how much more they're telling me how it went than when I'm reading it. I hadn't really considered that, but I guess that's a lot of responsibility.
For who?
For her, I guess, as the teller. Like, if she's the replacement for me getting to go back over that section over and over and reconsider it, but if it's happening in real time in audio and I'm not kind of scrubbing back or whatever they call it, then she's got to, if she's going to suggest a way for me to hear it just by the tone of her voice or the delivery, I guess there's more responsibility for her to be closer to at least something that agrees with what you meant.
I guess so. I mean, if you listen to you say it, I mean, it's also kind of a distortion, I guess. If you're listening to someone read it, they're kind of telling you how it is. Mm-hmm. And if they're reading it incorrectly, then what the author meant, well, it's too late. But at the same time, the point of it is a book, not an audiobook. But nonetheless, we're in 2020 and people that put out books want to put out an audio version too. So I'm just being pliable, like, oh, okay, sure, I can do that for you. And when I lived in the country 20 years ago, I started listening to books on tape while driving back and forth between Toronto. And that's when I learned, and I fell in love with a lot of it. And the ones that I liked the most were not read by the author. It was usually read by an actor. And it was kind of obvious why it was more interesting, because an actor wants to kind of study it. And the author is kind of like more, they don't necessarily, they kind of feel like, I already know this, I wrote this. So they're not necessarily charged up to perform an audio.
Yeah.
You know, like, so that's that.
I think the other interesting potential of the audio version is, I don't know if you experience this, but when I'm reading, I don't usually read, and then when I read again or go back to a place, I remember what I read. I think when I'm reading, I'm kind of in the book, and where I'm reading it becomes secondary. But when I'm listening to something, it often just becomes sort of embedded along with the visual of whatever it is I'm doing. So for radio, I really like to sit in the same place all the time, so that my slate is the same all the time, because that's maybe my best listening. If I changed where I am and then I'm listening to you change where you are, there's so many more variables that I'm more likely to start to have my curiosity pulled in ways that aren't completely to do with who I'm talking to. But when I'm listening to something, when I'm traveling, say, sometimes I find when I'm on that same road again, the thing I was listening to last time comes back. And so sure. I do think in the case of what you've written, that could be a really interesting thing, because they're all moments themselves. So if people start to have those moments come back, it's neat. I think it maybe does suit the form.
We have no way of knowing. I can't be in everyone's place as they listen to it to kind of assess that. But yeah.
Do you like that? I mean, this is something that happens in music too, and certainly something that I had to come to terms with quite early, is that I couldn't take things back. So I know I said earlier, like, I often operate or always operate as though things are out in the public forever and people see them. But that being said, with music, the first time somebody wrote to me and said they listened to one of my songs because they'd just broken up with somebody, and now it was kind of like the soundtrack of a very sad moment for them. And I remember being like, I didn't do that. That's not why I wrote it. And I had a really strange feeling about being part of such a tragic memory, and without my intention being there. But I mean, they were sharing it in a nice way, but it did make me think, like, how many other moments have I been in that I don't know about? And it kind of became exciting. Another one of those things where maybe anxiety immediately and quite shortly after liberation, of like, I'm going to be so many places, it almost doesn't matter where I go. And I wonder, like, as a musician or in writing this, if you are more excited by not knowing all the places that you found yourself, or if you like to do things picturing where they'll go.
No, it doesn't concern me. I don't think along those lines, because I don't know anything about that. All I know is making the work and trying to render the work to my taste, but once it's released to the world, to me, it's public domain. I get letters regularly from people, and even writing with Facebook, people ask me, can I post this? Can I share this? Or they ask if they can use this song or whatever. And I, you know, most of the time, what I try to get across, and sometimes just say it specific directly, is that it's public domain. Like, you don't have to ask me. To me, if it's like the premise that I could control it, and I know people are trying to be honorable or something when they put that to me, but I also feel like, you know, there's many more people that won't even put it to me and can just match it. I'm not interested in having that fight, so I just would rather say it's out there. You can turn it upside down, you can sample it, you can play parts of it backwards, add it to your record.
I mean, you did mention that quote earlier of forget the audience.
Right.
Do you never place an entity or an environment in the goal?
Do I never place an entity in the goal?
Well, say during the pandemic, when I've talked to musicians, some of what I've talked about with some of them is how some people use music as a sort of tool for sorting out their feelings and their thoughts, and you could almost compare it more to like a diary. And in that sense, maybe are not worried about whether or not any of what they're creating right now will ever be heard. It's maybe a way for them to be processing, but it's not necessarily with an audience in mind. And in some ways, it's maybe even easier to do that right now when you are deprived of even the option of an in-person audience. But I have both. I have moments where I do it for me without concern about where it will go. And then I have moments where I'm writing music, but then I'm recording it and absolutely have goals. I feel like I wrote this about this, and when it is recorded, I want it to be heard like this. I want this kind of person to hear themselves in it. And then I definitely have an audience in my mind when I make those types of decisions. Do you never have an audience?
I have that in mind too.
You do? Okay.
But once I've hit go, once I've hit send, you might struggle with saying something in an email. Like, oh, I can't put it like that. And well, as long as you're struggling with it, you're struggling with it. I'm not going to send it. I'm going to wait till tomorrow and look at it again. And then you look at it again tomorrow, and maybe you realize, oh my God, it's a good thing I didn't send. I got to remove that line. That's hostile or whatever. And then you do it again. And then at a certain point, you look at it and like, yeah, that's it. And then, okay, send. I don't feel bad once I hit that send button. And okay, there's nothing for me to worry about or to regret. You know, I decided, you know, the records that I make, they're like laying an egg, you know, and I work on it for a long time, and I consider it from many angles before it's like, okay, it's out in the world. And it's just, I just not invested in trying to control it once it's public.
Okay. I totally understand that. Yeah.
One of the interesting things I notice in the times that we are in more and more, that everyone's throwing the world up on YouTube, is that there are many demos now available of people who are long dead, that people are throwing demos up of, or here's whatever, you know, so-and-so, here's John Lennon working on Strawberry Fields, you know, or so-and-so before it was recorded. And a part of me is very amazed to hear that shit, because mm-hmm. I don't want you to hear that shit of mine. That's like me. I didn't put it out yet. So like, it's really a useful, if you study Nietzsche and you can read his notebooks before he put out his book, but I'm pretty sure Nietzsche would have wanted it burned and didn't want you to see what he wrote or the scribbles in it or the things that he didn't feel right about. But, you know, it's a real weird thing. But anyways, that's just another angle on the same thing.
Yeah. Well, in terms of performance, say, and I know that you do improvise. I know that you said you're going to be going and doing your PhD with the International Institute of Critical Studies and Improvisation. Where does improvisation sit for you when there's no audience? So I'm wondering if it's different maybe for you, if you have a different relationship with that medium and whether it needs to have people listening, whether that changes it again.
Yeah, I mean, the practice of improvisational music is very much like the practice of life. It's very much like trying to kind of tune into the fact that you don't know what happens next as mm-hmm. you're talking to someone or whatever. And, you know, doing it with instruments, I mean, you know, music in a lot of ways reminds us of life because we just only appear to be alive, you know, like we don't know why we're alive, but we know that we're alive and we know that we die. And you know that when you're close to your own death, whether that happens today or in 40 years from now, you know, when you actually are going to be close to your death, you're going to feel like it all happened in a second. And you know, the length of time that exists before you were born is unknown. As far as we are concerned, it's basically infinite. And the length of time that will exist after you're dead is the same thing. Like nobody has any idea how long those lines are. But it's really clear that they are so, so humongous that the extent that we occupy life is like a fraction of a blip of a quark of a spit. You know, it's like, so from a certain point of view, we're not even here.
Okay.
From a certain point of view, like the amount of life that we have or that we occupy is so tiny, so minuscule that, you know, and the other thing is we're in motion, we're in movement. We don't, you know, we're not a piece of wood, and even the piece of wood isn't still, it's decaying, but our experience is, so anyways, all that is a lot like music. Music isn't a thing. It's something that's in motion. It's moving. And as we organize listening to it as songs, we see it as a beginning, middle, and end. But if we listen to it as, you know, John Cage kind of called attention more to listening to tuning into sound as consciousness. And, or he kind of questioned why do we think there should be a composer? I mean, like, sound itself is a song, you know, like, the buzz in the room, the traffic going by, the birds doing their thing, that's all a song from a certain point of view. Anyways, all I'm getting at is that music kind of reminds us of life. And I think that's part of why we're so drawn to it. It's interesting that we're sculpting with sound, but it's also, on a certain primal level, perhaps, it reminds us of ourselves, that it appears to be alive. Because we only appear to be alive. Like, there's a real argument you could make for the fact that we're not here.
Okay.
So, in improvisational music, the part of what turns me on is that whole activity, that whole tradition, that whole objective of trying to be lifelike in how you're improvising. The improvisers that interest me and I think other people the most are the ones that appear to be the most alive. The most that sound that generate the most, or to put it another way, the ones that are less interesting are the ones that don't appear to be very creative, that appear to be dead, that appear to be just doing one thing over and over, and not really developing something that appears organic and alive.
I parts of that resonate with me in a big way. I think, like, even these interviews they're not really the beginning or end of all the conversation I could have with that person or any of that. And I've definitely really embraced how much I will never know about the impact any of it has. It's I'll never see the end. And so when you're describing the way you described it, I that does make a lot of sense to me, or that's the kind of brain space I think I live in too. Like, I think if you got to see the end, if you got to ever have a moment where you're like, this is the end of that thing I started, maybe that's very satisfying. I feel like I get way more excited at the end, keeps moving. I don't know. Has it changed during the pandemic? Has any of your sort of relationship with music, with writing, with life, has the pandemic shaped your like existence right now in a really significant way?
The pandemic's only reminded me of global events that I haven't experienced, you know, things that I've grown up with seeing referred to frequently, sometimes constantly, like war, particularly World War II, World War I, legacies of war and how it affects human behavior on the earth. That's what I think about the most with the pandemic, is like a part of me finds it really amazing how we are thinking about this thing as being a force everywhere, and how the government would organize in certain instances money for all sorts of people to kind of get by. You know, part of me, as much as there's criticism and people angry, as people always are, I'm also kind of blown away at some of the things that have happened that help a lot of the people get by. I like how it kind of makes you think about the invisibility of capitalism, about how it's as though the capitalist system can't work unless people are given money, because we're raised to think that it just is natural and it's completely invented. It's not natural at all. And so I like how the pandemic has kind of like shone a bright light on that for the moment, and people have to think about it. I like how the questions that people are trying to sort with music. You know, I'm part of the board of directors for a place in Toronto, the Transact, where a lot of people perform, and there's an open stage on Monday nights there, and so they've tried to continue having an open stage but do it through Zoom. And it's or they tried to do it on Instagram, and then now they're doing it on Zoom. And I hosted it recently, and it was really I really didn't enjoy trying to do an open stage that way, because everyone's looking at themselves. And so like you're not the thing I enjoy about being anonymous in the audience while someone else is the performer. Well, that's kind of out the window if we're doing it on Zoom. Now all of us are part of the performer too, and we're looking at ourselves sitting there passively or whatever. And I just found it boring. I didn't really, the kind of thing I get off on, does like the idea that this would supplement it doesn't really hold water for me. It was like a different thing, and it wasn't as interesting. I'm more interested in the real deal. Though Instagram in some ways could work, but yeah, I don't know where these questions, I don't know what the answers are to these questions, but there are new questions with the idea of people performing to computers alone in their rooms. It's interesting because there's something about having an audience that there's a value to the audience too. There's something else that I get, as much as I was saying the forgetting about the audience is valuable, and I don't think this is a contradiction, but there's another element of songwriting that's captured or that's achieved by getting on stage in front of a bunch of people with a song you wrote, especially when it's new, because there's a certain mystery to the song that you wrote alone in a room, which is that you have ideas about the song, about what's valuable about the song to you, but once you do it in front of people, it becomes confirmed that you were right, or it becomes confirmed that you were wrong, and nobody kind of cares at all about this thing. They find it dull or whatever. And all of that is that you gain a certain objectivity by doing the thing in front of people that you just can't gain alone in a room. And that never ceases to kind of amaze me.
Mm-hmm. I've struggled with a lot of the same kinds of, the only one, the thing I've enjoyed is sometimes I feel like people have gathered together that would have been an impossibility. So that, sometimes that's the part that I think about instead when I'm watching somebody perform online. I'm not maybe as excited that that's where they are, but when I see the comments and who's there, and they're people from all across the country or even across the world, and in real time we're watching it together, that seems like a new thing as opposed to a compromised version of an old one. And it's very easy, I think, to think of what all isn't happening or all of the things we love and the compromised versions of them right now. But there's starting to be new potentials that maybe we wouldn't have looked at otherwise. So the optimist in me, I guess, is excited to see which ones of those can be. We had an international Omnicord festival, and I've dreamed about that possibility. I wanted to have an international Omnicord band back in the early 2000s. And back then, technology didn't really enable that in any way. And so 20 years later, to have my dreams come true, because all of a sudden this festival made more sense than ever before. That was a really beautiful moment for me, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, and I didn't know who the audience was, but because of that, they could have been anybody. And that was kind of neat. I didn't have any evidence to prove me wrong about any of the people I was putting in that audience in my mind. Oh. I have two questions I've been asking pretty much everybody that I'd love to ask you. And one is around support. So if something has occurred to you during the pandemic that is missing in terms of support, something that feels like if it was implemented or if we did for ourselves or each other, it would make these times easier, or something that you've seen occurring that is actually like a really positive thing?
I don't know. I don't have a clue. I just kind of marveled at people realizing that they need to wear masks and at the end of it, they need to kind of like restrict their movement. And as tough as that is in some ways, I'm amazed by people who don't get it, who continue to kind of make things riskier for everybody else. But there's a certain amount of stupid that's always part of humanity. I'm actually really impressed by how many people have got the message and have like been careful with how to coordinate their interaction with others. And but your question is like, do I have thoughts about how people can help people during all this or other things? Then I don't know. I noticed some people have like given things away and made food available, but that's always something people could do to help people. So, but in terms of the pandemic, I mean, I imagine there'll be work at coming up with a vaccine, and eventually that might happen or not. You know, like certain things never had a vaccine. I don't think there's ever been a vaccine per se for SARS or AIDS, and the world adjusted and had to change some things. I have no wisdom about that. I'm just like any other poor schmuck who's just like adjusting to the fact that like, oh, okay, these are the rules now, for now. I'm kind of more amazed by the fact that people elect stupid people into positions of power frequently. That's more what blows my mind, that Doug Ford is the premier, that Rob Ford was the mayor of Toronto, that Trump's the president of America, that the choice for Americans will now be Trump or Biden. I mean, it's just so obvious, like the difference between people that are, you know, let's say in America, the AOC and people like Trump or Biden, like, it's just so obvious to a certain kind of person who's intelligent and who's not. But be that as it may, people elect people that don't deserve the job to be in positions of power frequently. And it's really freaky when it has to do with kind of the safety en masse of people. That doesn't answer your question either, but that's just what goes through my head about that question. It also says something about corruption, and it also says something about, I mean, to bring back that we are musicians, it comes back to this other thing that's very interesting, which is that, you know, a lot of people in the music world have oriented themselves to thinking that music is all about making money from music, and so that the goal is to have a song that's a hit song. And even that is a corrupt business. People pay, corporations pay radio and other kinds of outlets, bloggers, whatever, to kind of advertise their song or perpetuate their song. That's why people, you know, sing songs that they hate sometimes. And they're like, why am I singing a thing I hate? And I mean, and sometimes they think, oh, I guess it really is good. And okay, yeah, maybe it is really good. Or maybe that it's been played in the grocery store and it's played in the elevator and it's played everywhere because people are spending money doing that because things are corrupt. and that it's just and the brain is just like that. If you play a melody over and over, you'll start to sing it, you know. And it's that it's as simple as that. And it's the thing as that, that we're told, that people are told, well, the choice is Trudeau or, you know, like, and it's like, that's not the choice. I mean, there's many other voices that are intelligent and that are valuable. I mean, I think that's part of why the appeal of smaller politics is more appealing, like city, the city world. It's kind of, it's not as sexy and as important or as newsworthy as the national view, but the small town thing and who's the mayor and who are the counselors, it's almost more accountable. It's almost more based on real debate than these bigger things. And with music too, the local people who you actually see who are doing something might be way better at any given time than Billie Eilish or whoever people are thinking is a big deal. When, because from a certain point of view, that's just manufactured. Like, you can just, it just drips of manufactured concepts of music and values and images and language. And but en masse, people consume it, and so these are just part of the conditions of life and being alive.
Okay, well, my other question is one around silver linings. So just if there's something you've seen emerge during this time that has actually been kind of a bright spot, or something that you would actually love to see continued, even if we got to go back to something resembling normal?
Well, because things are corrupt there, and because of, there always will be, you know, energy that's moved because of capitalism, because of money, because of the interest in hoarding money, there'll always be energy spent on trying to profit in any way possible. So that one of the ways that that plays out that disturbs me is trying to erode the kind of national healthcare systems that exist. So one of the silver linings in all this is that it impresses people, or down the road, if someone's trying to privatize our system, people will remember that, like, oh, we didn't have to go and pay for tests or pay for a bunch of things under the COVID-19 pandemic because we had healthcare, you know. So, like, I see over years lobbying interests to try and take money out of healthcare, because there's an interest that moneyed medical and insurance corporations have in seeing our system fail so that they can make more money from the failure. And so it plays out by seeing political people take money out of the system. And they take money out of the system so that it will fail, so that they can point at it and say, you see, it's a nice idea, but you see, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because you took money out of it, but that's not part of how it ends up being reported. And so that might be a silver lining, I hope, is strengthening that. You see it happening kind of in America. It kind of stunts a lot of their conversations against national healthcare, the fact that it's so tragic the way people live in America without healthcare, and it's just so sensible to kind of make that a goal for humanity, to kind of cover health costs.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to see where things really get traction, and where there's stats and information we can point to when we need it that maybe were harder to define before. Well, Bob, I should let you get going. Do you want to share the title of the book and the links for folks who want to track it down?
The title of my book is Music Lessons by Bob Wiseman, but I don't know what the URL is. The company is ECW Press, and if you Google ECW Press, Bob Wiseman, you'd end up seeing the book. And my own website, bobwiseman.com, the book is, you know, it's available there, but it's in libraries too.
Awesome. Well, Bob, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed it.
Nice to talk with you. My pleasure.
So once again, that was Bob Wiseman in Toronto, Ontario. His book is called Music Lessons, and it's out on ECW Press. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.
isn't good for you. You may not realize it, but it's not. When you're right, you barely know what to do. You just sit around thinking and cry a lot. A ball and chain, a fiery inferno for you, holding you down.